This is Audible. The Devastation of Baal by Guy Haley. Read by Gareth Armstrong. Chapter 1. The Red Mist. Already the morning gongs were ringing when Ouija the waterseller roused himself for another day of thankless toil. Ouija rose fully clothed and went to empty his bladder into the homemade purification unit in the corner. Every drop of water was precious on Baal Secundus, whatever the source. His single-roomed home held three cots, a table, the recycle unit, and precious little else. Old transit pallets, heaped with threadbare blankets against the cold of desert night, were their beds. On the way to the recycle unit, Ouija passed his great burden, his idiot son. The boy had gone away to the chapter trials full of hope, and come back minus his wits. "Get up! Up, up, you little fool!" Ouija kicked at his son's booted foot. The boy thrashed awake and threw up his hands in alarm. A frightened face peeped out between filthy fingers. "Get up," growled Ouija. "Dawn's coming. Can't you hear the angels' gongs?" He looked out of a window of low-grade alabaster set into the wall of unpainted adobe. Daybreak should have shone pink through the stone. Instead, a red darkness lingered outside. Most mornings were cold but beautiful. The sky flawlessly smooth and tinted a deep rose by the light of the red scar. Sometimes the colours were enough to stop Ouija and make him forget how much he hated his life.
"Not that you can tell," grunted Ouija. "Red mist. A thick one, too."
"Do we have to, Da?" said the boy.
Ouija looked at the boy with clear hatred as he urinated into the recycle funnel.
Yes,
he spat back, mocking the boy's stutter. "Now up. I need help to fill the flasks. Age be cursed, or I'd turn you over to the Emperor's mercy and be rid of you."
Ouija adjusted his filthy clothes and stamped, bow-backed and swaying, to the door of gappy wood that separated the single room of his home from the goods yard outside. He clutched at his lower back as he reached for the door handle and rubbed fruitlessly at the pain in his bones, his mood souring further.
"Be kinder to the boy. He is my daughter's son," croaked the aged voice of the room's final occupant.
The coverings on the third bed shifted, the lump beneath them growing thin arms and knotted hands, as a woman even more wasted and hunched than Ouija emerged.
"You owe him some love for her memory, if you can't summon some for the boy himself."
The old woman coughed hard. Phlegm rattled around her throat. Ouija looked at her in disgust. Her face was as deeply lined as the pit of a fruit, as if time had rotted away the pleasant outer flesh, leaving the bitter, craggy interior of her soul exposed for all to see.
"Where's your daughter now, you old witch?" he said. "Dead. Dead and gone, leaving me with a fool and a crone for company."
"You are cruel," said the old woman.
Clustered carcinomas blighted her face. She had only a few more months of life in her, but her eyes were bright and shrewd. Ouija hated her eyes most of all.
"The Emperor will punish you,"
Ouija snarled.
"We all starve long before the Emperor notices if you and your precious grandson don't rouse yourselves. We must be at the gates before they open for the day."
The woman shrank back into her blankets.
"The red mist is here. You'll have no customers."
Ouija rested his hand on the piece of scrap he had fashioned into the door handle. It was worn almost featureless. He had unearthed the metal in his youth from one of the moon's ruined cities. An unidentified artifact of the system's lost paradisal past, it could once have been a piece of art. It could have been a component from a wondrous machine. It could have been anything. Now it was old, ugly, and broken, suitable only for the coarsest work, just like Ouija.
"Then we will starve. Get up. We go to work."
He flipped the door open, letting it bang into the wall to show his anger. The red mist was the worst he'd ever seen, a choking thick vapor laden with sand particles. Only on a low-gravity lunar body like Baal Secundus was such a phenomenon possible, though Luigi didn't know that. His worldview was necessarily limited. What he saw was a day's business ruined. Red mist was iron-sharp in smell and texture, a soupy broom that lacerated the nostrils. He coughed and pulled up his scarf to cover his mouth and nose. He had no clip to hold it in place, so he pressed it to the contours of his face with his left hand. Though his home was modest, his stockyard contained a fortune. 4 huge terracotta urns, taller than men, and too wide for the embrace of 2 people to meet around, lined the wall. With such wealth to protect, the courtyard was better built than the house. The walls were of stone, not mud brick, and high, the tops studded with rusty spikes and broken glass. The gate was deliberately small, triple-barreled, plated in scavenged metal, upon whose pocked surfaces the marks of the ancients were still visible when the light was right. There was no sun. The early day was tainted a bloody murk. The urns were looming shapes, the wall invisible. The yard was little over 20 feet side to side, but the red mist was so dense that day, Luigi could not see across. He paused. At the very least, the fog would be full of toxins given off by Baal Secundus's poisoned seas. If the sands in the mist had been picked up over one of the old cities, the rad levels would be high. Luigi supposed he should fetch his rad ticker from inside. Frankly, he could not motivate himself to retrieve it. He was old. A dose of radiation from the Badlands could not shorten his life by much, and if it did, what of it? He was tired of life. It was hard and unforgiving. Sometimes he thought of ending it all. The misery, the graft, the wearing company of his son and mother-in-law. He had no illusions death would bring a happy afterlife in the Emperor's care. All he wanted was peace. He could not bring himself to do it. The mindless will of genes forced him to continue living, which he did, begrudgingly. Blinking gritty moisture from his eyes, he headed for the lean-to where he kept his cart. A pair of tall wheels bracketed 2 cargo beds, one above the other. 3 dozen clay flasks were on each level. He fetched the first and took it to the tap attached to the nearest urn. To fill it, he had to let his scarf drop. The dust in the midst tickled his nose, and he swore. Rusty water ran into the bottle, making him want to piss again. His bladder was another thing that was failing him.
"Boy! Boy, get out here and help me!"
The door creaked. Out came the old woman instead, her face veiled in the ridiculous manner of her desert tribe. Luigi should never have married out of town.
"Where's that damn boy?" growled Luigi.
"Let him breakfast, you old miser. He'll be out in a moment."
"He's a waste of food and water," said Luigi.
He shut off the tap, pressed the cap closed on the bottle, and fetched another flask.
"It's not his fault," said the old woman.
"I think we all know that it's the angel's fault," said Luigi quietly.
"Shh," she said. "That is heresy. Would you leave him without a father as well as his mind?"
"He went to the trials of strong youth and was returned to me a fool. Who else should I blame?"
"Fate," she said. "He was not meant to join them, and he is getting better."
"He is not," said Luigi sourly.
He set the full flask into his cart and fetched a third. The crone shuffled across the courtyard to the cart, her long skirts disturbing the moist sand of the ground. There she stopped, but she did not help, only watched him, a judgmental phantom in the fog. Luigi gave her a filthy look. In her gnarled hands, a small auto-tarot deck made its tooth-grinding clicks. She pushed the button at the side. The tiles behind its scratched viewing pane clattered into place. She studied the little pictures on them a moment, then pressed the button again, then again. Luigi fought the urge to strike her, to knock the tarot from her hand and cast her out. The tarot was the instrument of the Emperor. Even he balked at such blasphemy.
"Help me, then," he said.
He squinted at the sky.
"The sun is rising."
The fog remained as thick as ever, but the light behind it was getting stronger.
"We're late."
The old woman hooked her tarot deck to her rope belt, took a flask up, and went to the second urn.
"Today is a day of great portents," she said.
"You say that every day," said Luigi.
The woman shrugged.
"Today, it is true."
"Nonsense," he said.
But he was wary of what she said. She had a knack for reading the tarot. He half believed she was a witch. In truth, he was frightened of her. He slammed the latest filled flask into the cart, hard, making the others rattle.
"Where is that boy?"
The boy pushed the cart. At least he was good for that. Luigi and the old woman walked behind. The flasks knocked and clinked in their trays, warning others they were coming. It was a good advertisement, but under the cover of the fog the noise made Luigi nervous. For all that Angel's Fall was under the direct administration of the Blood Angels, there was always the possibility of robbery on a day of mist. They met no misfortune as they walked the street from Waterer's Row towards the Sanguinian Way, the small city's main street. There were precious few people about. Those figures that appeared suddenly out of the murk were swaddled head to foot, and just as quickly disappeared.
"Quicker, boy," grumbled Luigi. "We want a good spot. I want to get there before they're all gone."
They turned onto the Sanguinian Way. At its far end was the place of choosing, where the giant statue of the great angel spread his arms and wings to face the eastern sky. Immense though Sanguinius's effigy was, the fog obscured it totally. With the majestic statue hidden, the cramped, low building that made up Angel's Fall seemed ruder than ever. It did not look like a holy city. The fog forced attention onto its inadequacies. Even the Sanguinian Way was meanly proportioned and crooked. Without Sanguinius, Angel's Fall could have been any town on any backward, arid world in the galaxy. Gongs boomed from unseen towers, signifying the start of the Peace Day markets. Only a handful of stalls had been set up at the roadside, and foot traffic on the way was low. Luigi reckoned visitors to Angel's Fall would be fewer than usual, though there were always some. The red mist discouraged travel. Not only was it toxic, but Baal's violent wildlife hunted under its cover. He cursed his luck. Water was expensive to both the buyer and the seller. The price he'd get for his stock barely covered the cost, and he owed a lot of money to Anton the regularizer. Anton took prompt payment of debts very seriously. Luigi rubbed at the stump of his left little finger, a reminder of the last time he'd been late with a payment. Anton had been nothing but apologetic. He had said he had no choice. Luigi thought they would have to stay out late, selling to people exiting the city to travel in the cool of the night. Assuming the mists lift today at all, he fretted. Such a fog was rare. Baal Secundus's principal weathers were wind and dust storms, but there was not a breath of a breeze today.
"This weather is unnatural," he said.
"A day of portents," said his mother-in-law in satisfaction.
"Shut up," he said. "It's just a day. Boy, here."
Luigi pointed out a patch of ground in the lee of the Temple of the Emperor. The temple occupied a whole block by itself, and another of Angel's Fall's major streets intersected the Sanguinian Way there.
"This'll do."
The gongs continued to ring.
"Why all this racket?" Luigi said.
"Happenings. Balfora has much in store for us today," said the old woman, using the local name for Baal Secundus.
She settled herself down. Her joints grumbled, and she grumbled back at them, forcing her old legs to cross. Upon skirts held taut between her knees, she set her tarot deck and began repetitively clicking at the workings. Luigi bared his teeth at her. He took out his irritation on the boy.
"Come on, boy, set out the table. Where are the cups? By the Emperor, we'd all die if you were in charge here."
Sorry, Father, said the boy.
"Don't call me that," he said. "My son is dead, stolen by angels. There is no one to inherit my business once I'm gone. Do not presume your place."
The boy bowed his head to hide his tears, showing the ugly scar running across the top of his head. Luigi hated the sight of that most of all. He was sure, had his boy not fallen, he would be up there on Baal as a warrior of the Emperor. He stared at it as the boy set up a little table that unfolded out from the side of the cart and put out a set of small bronze cups. Something like grief hurt him. He responded with anger.
"Quicker," he snapped.
The gongs were still booming long after they should have stopped. He squinted into the dim morning. There was another sound, a distant rumbling, under the clamour of the gongs.
"What is that?" he whispered.
"For void ships,"
ventured the boy.
"Silence," snapped Luigi.
But even as his anger flew out of his mouth, he thought the boy might be right. Angel's Fall was no stranger to the ships of the angels. There were off-worlders, too, who came to pay their respects to the place where Sanguinius, purest of the Emperor's progeny, was discovered. But rarely did they arrive in such numbers that the sound of their descent was so constant. Luigi heard the crunch of heavy feet on sand coming down the way. He swore at himself. Angels. They would have no use for his water.
"Bow! Bow!"
he hissed. He dropped his head and forced his idiot son to kneel. A huge armored figure emerged from the murk. Armor black, his helm cast in the shape of a skull. A space marine priest. Death incarnate. Luigi trembled. He dropped to his knees in fright, waiting for the figure to pass by. He did not. The footsteps stopped by the little cart. Luigi felt the angel's regard upon him. His bladder twinged yet again.
"Be at peace, blessed son of Baal Secundus," said the warrior.
His voice was inhumanly deep and thickly accented. Luigi looked up. The grimacing skull stared down at him. Breathing hoses were clamped between its stylized teeth and eye lenses of glowing green set below the angry brow. The armor hissed and whined in response to micro-shifts in the space marine's posture, making Luigi more afraid. The warrior looked down both streets of the crossroads.
"The great square. Where is it?"
Though made hollow and booming by its projection machinery, the warrior's voice was kindly. Still, Luigi could not see past the terrible visage glowering at him. He stared dumbly back.
"Water seller, I mean you no harm," said the angel. "I came to pay my respects to my lord. Where is his statue?"
Luigi trembled and flung up his arm. He intended to say,
"That way, my lord."
A strangled mule came out of his mouth instead.
"My thanks and my blessings," said the chaplain. "The emperor keep you."
He glanced up at the great temple, then strode away.
"Why does he not know?"
said the boy stupidly.
"I do not know," said Luigi.
Still upon his knees, he gazed fearfully at the departing giant.
"More,"
said the boy, and shrank back behind the cart. Luigi followed his son's wavering finger. More space marines, dozens of them. Luigi had never seen so many at one time, and his body shook in terror. They walked past, armor dull in the foggy daylight. Luigi could see clearly enough to know they were not blood angels. Their armor was adorned in a similar manner to that of the Masters of Baal. The heavy plates were beautifully formed, covered in scrollwork and delicate embellishments, and decked with bloodstone drips cased in gold, but the red of their armor was an unfamiliar hue. Their helms and trim were white, and their markings were strange. Luigi watched, amazed, as the column of warriors moved by in solemn silence, voiceless but for the growls and hum of their armor. It was not unusual to see other angels claiming descent from the great angel in Angel's Fall, but only in ones and twos. When a second group in yet different colors marched by, these armored half in black and half in bloody red, Luigi's mouth fell open. The gongs boomed. Outside the wall, the roaring of breaking jets grew louder.
"There's hundreds of them,"
stuttered the boy. For a moment, Luigi forgot his anger and put his arm around his broken son.
Why so many?
The boy said.
"They come to pay respect to their father. They come to pray," said Luigi. "It is a marvel."
The old woman chuckled, a low growling sound like a felid about to bite. The tarot tiles rattled.
"What is it?"
Luigi said. The old woman's smile was evident in her voice.
"The burning tower, the bloody angel, the falling star, the foundered void ship. These are fell signs."
Luigi looked sharply back at her.
"What do you mean?"
The old woman regarded him through the cloth of her veil.
"They are not coming here to worship, you foolish man," she said. "They have come here to die."
Chapter 2. The Coming Shadow. Across the central deeps of the Ultima Segmentum, the red scar spread its sanguine pall. A stellar desert, tinted bloody, hard, and inimical to man. The suns imprisoned within its bounds were all red in colour, whether senescent supergiants or early sequence infants. Deadly radiation bathed this benighted subsector, rendering its worlds uninhabitable by any sane measure. The Imperium had long passed the point of sanity. Perhaps because of their situation, the planets of the Scar were rich in exotic resources, and so generations of humanity had lived out brief lives under baleful stars, toiling at the will of the High Lords of Terra. Sustained by elixirs manufactured on Satis, the inhabitants of the Cryptus, Vitria, and other systems afflicted by the Scar's poison lived a life, of sorts, in service of the species. Against all the odds, by human ingenuity and for human greed, there had been billions of humans in the Red Scar region. So it might have been for generations more, but nothing is permanent, and mankind no longer held sway. The Tyranids had come to the Scar, scouring every world they encountered down to the bedrock, to feed an ancient and powerful hunger, extirpating humanity in the process. The invader was Hive Fleet Leviathan, by Imperial designation, though the governing intelligence of the Hive Mind made no such distinctions between the component parts of its body. To its incomprehensibly vast intellect, Leviathan was a limb, a foot, or an arm. If the Hive Mind regarded Leviathan as distinct from the other fleets devouring the galaxy in some way, it was by categories too alien for men to understand. From across the cold gulfs of intergalactic space, the Hive fleets had come, moving from one feeding ground to the next. The Hive Mind did not know and did not care what its food called itself, but noted in its alien way the strangeness of this prey cluster, an environment where the realities of the mind and form were intermingled. There was risk there, but good hunting in the dangerous shoals. The galaxy teemed with life, and the Hive Mind glutted itself on a staggering array of biological abundance. From the human point of view, the tyrannic wars had raged for close to a half millennium. In that time, hundreds of imperial worlds had been devoured, several minor races had been consumed, thousands of unknown planets outside the Imperium's notice had been turned from living orbs to rocky spheres that would never bear life again. Had the High Lords of Terra known how devastating the Tyranids truly were, they may have acted sooner. Like the mythical plagues of locusts of old Earth, the Tyranids stripped everything they came across bare. With each feast, the Hive Mind became stronger, absorbing the genetic profiles of everything it devoured and adding their strengths to its own. With every new creature eaten, its repertoire of genetic tricks grew. When it encountered a threat, it adapted. Its methods became more efficient, its fleets more numerous. Its creatures proliferated and multiplied, the essences of the galaxy's worlds converted into yet more elements of the never-ending swarms. So overwhelming was the threat it posed, the race had been declared periculo summa magna, and was deemed by many departments within the Imperium's high echelons as the most serious challenge to mankind's continued existence. They were wrong about that, but only by a little. These were dangerous years, well blessed with horrors. Nevertheless, the Hive Mind did not advance unopposed. There were brave men and women, heroes all, who stood against it no matter that the odds were impossible, and death was their only reward. Imperial losses were many, victory was rare. At many junctures, the Blood Angel Space Marines had defied High Fleet Leviathan, stealing away its food, and in some cases destroying its splinter fleets in their entirety. The Hive Mind responded to them as it did to other threats in the prey cluster, creating new beasts to beat the defenses of its prey, improving those it already possessed, and devising new strategies. All to no avail. Though pushed back, the red prey warriors fought on. At Cryptus,
the Blood Angels performed one last supreme effort, destroying a tendril of the greater whole, in truth a trivial victory at the cost of a rich system. Nothing could halt Leviathan's encroachment on the Red Scar. After Cryptus, there was Baal, homeworld of the Blood Angels, lying directly in the swarm's path. This was not accidental. The sages of the Imperium thought the hive mind a non-sentient intelligence. They believed the actions of the myriad creatures in its swarms were performed instinctively, and that the sheer numbers of interactions between them gave rise to complex behavior. At the very highest level, these behaviors were remarkable, but only had the resemblance of thought. Ultimately, instinct drove the high fleets, they said, not free will. Similar force intelligences had been witnessed so very many times in social animals across space, after all, from the ants of ancient Earth to the thought trees of Demaria. The hive mind's actions could be ascribed to sentient consideration, but the sages insisted they were nothing of the sort. The biologians held the hive mind to be only a complicated animal, a supreme predator, driven by a devastatingly powerful reactive mind, nevertheless devoid of soul. It was an automaton, they said. Unfeeling. It was as unaware of what it did as the wind is unaware of a cliff whose face it scours away, grain by grain. The hive mind was biological mechanics writ large, mind from mindlessness. The Imperial scholars were wrong. The hive mind knew. The hive mind thought, it felt, it hated, and it desired. Its emotions were unutterably alien, cocktails of feeling not even the subtle Eldari might decipher. Its emotions were oceans to the puddles of a man's feelings. They were inconceivable to humanity, for they were too big to perceive. The hive mind looked out of its innumerable eyes towards the dull red star of Baal. It apprehended that this was the hive of the warriors that had hurt it so grievously, who had burned its feeding grounds and scattered its fleets. It hated the red prey, and it coveted them. Tasting their exotic genomes, it had seen potential for new and terrible war beasts. And so it drew its plans, and it set in motion its trillion bodies towards the consumption of the creatures in red metal, so that their secrets might be plundered and re-employed in the sating of a hive mind's endless hunger. This was deliberate, considered, and done in malice. The hive mind was aware, and it desired vengeance. Commander Dante walked the Arx Murus, the great encircling wall of the Arx Angelicum, as the Blood Angels' fortress monastery was known. The Dome of Angels was closed against the coming war. Its huge armor-glass blister rose gently behind him. Several square miles of triangular panes, sparkling in Baal's midday sun, capped the Arx Angelicum's ancient caldera in impenetrable diamond. The Arx was a double spike of dark rock that stood alone in the sands of the endless desert. Of the primal form of the volcano it had been, little remained, for it had been carved into something more fitting for the dwelling of angels long ago. The fires in its heart were extinguished. Where lava once flowed, space marines held court. A trained geologian would have guessed at its natural shape. But though both peaks had been thoroughly remade by the hands of man, a hint of their origins remained. For all their adornment, their base form was that of twin cones, one smaller than the other, their throats open to the sky. In every other way, the Arx Angelicum was the work of mankind. The caldera rim had been remade into the high walls of the Arx Murus. The broad and mighty war walk broken by the many towers of the Blood Angel suborders. The Murus plunged 40 sheer yards to the uppermost of a series of tiered firing galleries that, reinforced by towering redoubts, marched belligerently down to the sand. From towers shaped as gaping angels' faces or screaming eagles, the muzzles of defensive lasers and macro-cannons aimed at the ever-present threat of the void. Other, smaller outcrops around the arcs had been refashioned into towers and squat forts, bearing guns big enough to down a void ship. The fury of the world's heart that had boiled within the volcanoes might have gone, but a different rage had taken its place. To Dante's right, The Heavenward Redoubt, the fortress monastery's keep, swelled out of the inner wall, the skull-faced citadel reclusium atop it, squatting athwart the wall-walk, beyond the cursed Tower of Amareo, speared the sky. The uppermost towers of the Librarius fringed the walls on the far side of the Dome of Angels, while the Sanguis Corpusculum, the bulwark domain of Corbulo and his sanguinary priests, thrust up from the lesser peak, its flat head joined to the main wall by a broad, armoured bridge. The interior of the volcano was as heavily transformed. The throat had been widened to the same diameter as the giant lava chamber beneath it, so that the floor of the arcs was many stories beneath the level of the desert. The inner walls had been smoothed and carved. Buttresses, fashioned as giant angels, ringed the interior, and the walls between were pierced with thousands of gleaming windows. All was done with exquisite care, and gloriously embellished with stone and metal. When the star Baelor shone directly overhead, the throats of the arcs blazed with a rubicund refulgence, dazzling those lucky enough to witness it. The Arx Angelicum was truly among the most beautiful fortresses in all the galaxy. Towards the bottom of the shaft, the tiered steps of the fortress exterior were repeated, but these sprouted with greenery, not guns, the Verdis Elysia, the marvellous farmlands where the Blood Angels grew their food, and parklands that preserved the fragmentary remains of Baal Primuses and Baal Secunduses, once vibrant ecosystems. Baal had forever been a desert planet, but not its moons. Their toxic wastes were of man's doing. Baal's cloudless sky was busy with the crossed contrails of landing craft. Shoals of blunt-nosed space marine attack craft crowded the planet's anchorages. Dozens of battle barges formed the nexus of fleets arrayed in cramped formation. The largest of the vessels were miles long, and clearly visible at the height of day as pale, dreamlike shapes. Their attendant escorts were albedo phantoms, and the smallest were bright stars moving rapidly in dense clusters. Baal Secundus was rising in the west, Baal Primus setting in the east. The two rarely shared the same sky. For shame, local legend had it. Baal's moons were close to their mother planet and large. The arcs of their spheres framed the activity in orbit, but like a picture overfull with detail, the gathered fleets of the Blood Angels' successor chapters spilled out from the gap between the moons and Baal's horizon, and the blocky shapes of their ships swarmed over the moon's surfaces also. Giant, man-made objects sailed over the mottled patchwork of desert and toxic seas of Baal Secundus, while the ugly scarring of Baalin's necklace on Baal Primus caught flights of support craft in the rings of its craters. Activity in the void was mirrored on the ground. Machinery rumbled all around the extinct volcano. The peace of Baal had fled into the deeper deserts. Dunes that had lapped at the feet of the Arx Angelicum were being bulldozed away, uncovering structures abandoned after the sundering of a chapter in the mythical past. Once, the fortress monastery had been even more expansive. It surprised Dante to see how much had been left to the sands by his forebears. Throughout his thousand-year reign as chapter master, relics of ancient eras had occasionally been uncovered by powerful storms, offering glimpses into the past. Despite his deep knowledge of the chapter records, the outer fortress was largely unknown. To see uncovered landing fields thronged with warriors and machines was as if the days of the Great Crusade lived again. Dante had led his warriors longer than any other man in the Imperium. Indeed, there were very few humans older than he. Among all mankind's trillions, had every person approached Dante's age gathered together, they would hardly fill a strike cruiser. He had known that Leviathan was coming for some time. His efforts at Cryptus were his last chance to delay. Only at Baal, only here, could the vast tendril that had ravaged the Red Scar perhaps be destroyed, and only by titanic effort. Dante had called upon all the chapters of the Blood, all those space marines that shared Sanguinius's heritage, and their warriors had come by the thousand. As soon as he sent out his plea for aid to the successor chapters of the Blood Angels, Dante ordered a grand scheme of works begun, setting the chapter's blood thralls and its cohorts of servitors the task of preparing for the gathering host. For miles around the Arx Angelicum, they had dug into the ground, pushing back the desert, in some places excavating far down to where the sand had begun its slow transformation into stone. In the process, the forgotten structures had been uncovered. Bunkers, towers, and a circling wall, marked on none of the ancient maps, were unearthed. Most of the structures outside the Arx Angelicum were useless ruins, foundations filled with rubble and rough lumps of metal melted in forgotten battles. But the rediscovered wall itself was viable, an unexpected bulwark against the coming threat. Dante was too wise a man to see the wall as a sign. It was coincidence, and the extra protection gave him little cheer. Teams of mortals rebuilt the wall as he watched. Within its circuit sheltered the arriving host. Aged rockcrete landing fields, freed from the sand, were once again in use. Hundreds of craft lay in neat ranks, radiating out from newly erected command centers, their formations on the ground making interlocking circles of red, black, white, and gold. There were thousands upon thousands of space marines on Baal. To accommodate them, the deepest halls of the Arx Angelicum had been thrown open. Built for a legion, the fortress monastery could have housed 20 chapters, and now it was called upon to do so again. Even so, there was not enough space for all the newcomers, and barrack houses interspersed the command centers, dotting the fields. The number of brother chapters was impressive, a portent of victory, the rash said. The assembling battle brothers drew strength from the presence of so many others like themselves. Among the warriors present were thousands who had never been to sacred Baal, whose only contact with the father chapter were infrequent and resented visits from the Blood Angels' high chaplains. Their ways were strange to those of the Blood Angels, and many were markedly different in appearance and behavior. Although none but the Blood Angels could lay claim to birth on the triple worlds of Sanguinius's finding, and were thus not of the sacred tribes of the Blood, ultimately their gene seed derived from Sanguinius's. All were of his lineage, and bonds more terrible and deeper than those between any other chapters existed. Brotherhood spread its web across Baal more tightly than at any time since the Emperor walked among men. Yet this did not bring Dante joy either. A long line of transports flew down from the fleets, stacked up so far that the hindmost were motile glints. Gunships and lifters, lighters and bulklanders, conveyed an endless line of material to the spiritual home of Sanguinius's sons. A score of chapters emptied their ship's holds of weapons, tanks, ammunition, and more. The supplies were welcome. A third war was being erected out beyond the unearthed second. This last was of the low, prefabricated segments all Space Marine chapters were equipped with. More were being made as Dante watched. Auto-castellators scooped up huge buckets of sand and dumped them into hopper molds on their trailers. With great heat and pressure, the sand was crushed into shape. Fresh, steaming segments of defense line were dropped onto the desert to be dragged into place by waiting haulers. Formations of vehicles in varied shades of red were parked around the monastery. Down aisles formed of slab-armored tanks, hundreds of tech marines from across the galaxy walked, sharing their ideas and experience with eager listeners. Dante kept his progress slow around the Arx, so that he might better see the host of angels. Baelor, Baal's large ruby sun, made his golden armor red. Airborne sand whispered against the ceramite of his shell. The Arx Angelicum was so tall that the noise of the army marshalling in the desert and all the sounds of work as Baal fortified itself were reduced to faint suggestions of themselves. Engines were puttering disturbances. Myriad conversations were reduced to infrequent, thin shouts. The rumble of jets was as quiet as the hiss of sand on sand. Though his hearing was as sharp as any Space Marine's, this was all Dante heard. He left his vox speeds off and his auto-senses dormant. Having spent sleepless weeks welcoming the stream of arrivals and formulating his strategies, he sought peace on the wall, seizing it where it did not come to him voluntarily. The host gathered at his feet, in rich desert quiet. Every half mile, a pair of winged sanguinary guard stood in vigil. They saluted their master as he passed. The warriors wore gear nearly identical to Dante's, but the masks of the sanguinary guard showed the features of their wearer. Of all men, Only Dante wore Sanguinis's face. Only he had that burden. Baal Secundus moved up the sky, obscuring the edge of the sun and bringing a transient dusk to the desert world. This little darkness would pass in an hour as Baal Secundus continued its orbit and day would resume. Eclipses were an everyday occurrence on all three of the Baal triple. There was nothing so simple as day and night on any of them. As the moon covered more of Baelor, the dark grew and the temperature dropped. A sudden warm wind blew out of the desert, stirring the flags of the Blood Angels into motion and making Dante's cloak snap. Fittingly, it was in that short spell of night that Mephiston came to him, emerging from one of the Ark's Murus's many-armored doors. Geron Leta, the master of astropaths, walked in his black shadow. The Blood Angels' chief of librarians was a figure almost as legendary as Dante. Among the most potent psychers in the Adeptus Astartes, Mephiston's power was known across the Imperium. But while Dante was celebrated and his leadership sought, Mephiston was shunned. He was secretive and feared by all. Mephiston did nothing to counter this opinion. His armor was cast to resemble the exposed musculature of a flayed man, incongruously framed in gold. Every fiber of a human's exposed subdermal anatomy had been lovingly reproduced in ceramite, the horrible made no less disturbing by the artistry employed. His armor was a deeper red than the Blood Angel's norm, a dark arterial crimson lacquered to a high gloss, so that Mephiston's gory panoply glistened as if wet. He habitually went unhelmeted. A psychic hood of unusual design framed his face. Mephiston was inhumanly beautiful in a chapter renowned for physical perfection, and the scholiasts of the Blood Angels insisted he looked much like Sanguinius himself. If Mephiston did take after their gene father, it was Sanguinius, dead. For Mephiston's perfection was that of a sarcophagus effigy. His troubled soul made beauty into ugliness, and the freezing hard light in his eyes was enough to frighten the bravest man. Leta was another exceptional example of his type. He had survived the soul binding with his senses intact. Virtually every other astropath Dante had encountered in his long life had been blind, their eyes burned out by their communion with the Emperor, while some had no earthly senses remaining to them at all. This singular characteristic was the mark of Leta's power and Leta's will as much as it was of the infinite grace of the Emperor. That such a prized operative as Leta had been assigned to the Blood Angels was a token of how highly the chapter was regarded by the Adeptus Astrotelepathica. Leta's second sight was as extraordinary as his first. He could commune across space with the librarians of the chapter, bypassing his fellow astropaths. He could pierce the most terrible of veils, catch the most degraded teleprayer on the treacherous currents of the Empyrean. Leta could see through all but the shadow in the warp. That remained opaque, even to him. Seeing his chief librarian approach, Dante stopped and awaited his arrival. Mephiston greeted him. Leta knelt, head bowed, until Dante told him to rise.
"My lord, how goes the muster?" said Mephiston.
His voice was dry and whispery. During true night, it was stronger. Something in the chief librarian loathed the day.
"It goes well," said Dante. "Our brothers move quickly as they must. The High Fleet will soon be here. Time has been generous to us, but it runs out."
Dante could not stop looking up into the sky, past the fleet, the moons, and the sun, to where swarms of Xenos monstrosities swam the killing depths of space towards Baal.
27 chapters have already arrived, my lord," said Leta.
Though he had knelt out of respect as a senior member of another adepta, Leta had no qualms about speaking freely in front of a chapter master.
"More have promised their help. There are chapters of the blood here that are not on any roll the chief librarian scholiasts can unearth for me. In my wildest hopes, I could not have dreamed of such a response."
Leta's long emerald robe moved violently in the eclipse wind. His remarkable eyes sparkled with fervor.
"The sons of the great angel are loyal," said Mephiston.
"There are over 15,000 sons of Sanguinius in system already," said Dante. "Estimates suggest we may eventually be blessed with as many as 25,000. Every warrior that comes here
is another stone in our defences against Leviathan. Dante could feel Mephiston watching him closely. Dante had changed in the last months. The weariness he strived so hard to hide from others had fallen away, and his vigour had returned. But he had also become dour, his outlook grim. Dante's last equerry, Arafeo, had offered up his blood at the end of his service. Dante could not have refused had he wanted to. From death, Dante's newfound energy came. Death would be his reward for it. Dante was sure Mephiston could sense all this. So it should be. Dante made no effort to hide his shame from the librarian. "Is there news from Cadia?" Dante asked.
"Not much, my lord," said Mephiston, "and what little there is ill-favored. The forces of Chaos gather in crushing strength at the Diamor system. Since Astaroth sent word that he and Captain Sendini were en route to Diamor, we have heard nothing. Carlean, Aphael, and Phaeton should have arrived by now."
"We have had no notice of their safe translation," said Leta quietly. "Could they have fallen?" said Dante.
Mephiston closed his eyes for a moment. His face was as still as a funeral mask. In his armor, it was impossible to tell if he breathed. Not for the first time, Dante wondered if he did.
"They still live," Mephiston said. "I would know if they did not." "That is something, at least. We of the Librarium will travel to Baal Secundus and add our senses to those of the astropaths at the relay there. Perhaps we will hear something soon. In the meantime, there are better tidings."
The Lord of Death motioned to Leta. The astropath held out a scroll case of polished hematite, decorated with bloodstone drops.
"In this case," said Leta, "are details of astropathic communiques from 6 of the battle fleets you have scouring the nearmost worlds. They are disturbingly fragmentary. Already the shadow in the warp creeps over our territory and disrupts our communication. The content is clear enough. Their work proceeds. The Tyranids will find nothing to fuel their advance. Many chapters march at your command. It is as if the Legion of old is reborn."
"Perhaps," said Dante. He was wary of Leta's implicit comparison of him with Sanguinius, and concerned for the future. His every effort thus far had proved insufficient to stop Leviathan. "I fear it will not be enough."
"Though it is a sight, is it not?" said Mephiston.
Tellingly, he did not speak out against Dante's fears. Neither of them had much faith in their ultimate triumph. Both of them had faced the great devourer several times, most recently at the Pyrrhic victory at Cryptus. They had witnessed the hive mind's power firsthand.
"I wonder if this is what our father saw when he marshalled his legion here, those millennia ago. I feel close to him, seeing this. The dark we face is great, but it is a fine thing to come closer to the Primarch."
"To see an echo of what he saw with our living eyes is an honour."
Dante was forever conscious of the sacred ruby affixed to his brow. Inside the hollow vessel was the last unadulterated liquid drop of blood taken from Sanguinius's veins, preserved for all time.
"He is always with me, librarian. He is always with all of us."
"In our blood and our souls,"
agreed Mephiston, a truth more literal than figurative. Sanguinius's visions haunted their dreams and hounded them to their deaths. A war deemed ancient by others was, to blood angels, the betrayal of yesterday.
"By his blood were we made."
Dante nodded.
"By his blood he is within all of us, and we will need his strength now more than ever."
Chapter 3. Eaters of the Dead. The signature state of a Space Marine warship when not in battle was quiet bustle. Second Captain Irwin of the Angels Excelsis had a fine view of his serviles at work. The splendid Pinion's throne platform was set upon a pier projected high over the work pits and instrument banks of the command bridge. Up there, he was as separate from the serviles as an angel in a primitive heaven is separate from the mortal sphere. And so it should be, he thought. Sergeant Ackerman was his only company on the platform, flicking through reports on a dozen screens to Irwin's left. Ackerman's square face was fixed in concentration. It was possible he was not deep in thought, but just as bored as Irwin was.
The captain was in poor spirits. His thirst troubled him when he had little to occupy his talents. This slow road to Baal goaded the monster in his breast. He despised inactivity. The splendid pinion's deck was 400 feet across, with a domed roof as lavishly decorated as any cathedral's. Servo skulls and tethered cyber devices drifted below friezes depicting great triumphs of the chapter. Around the rear of the circular room were galleries, screened with metal fretwork to hide the servitors and lesser serviles labouring there. The screens were beautiful, but Irwin thought them a compromise of function and art. The front arc of the command deck was aesthetically finer. Columns of glittering white stone ribbed the walls. Fine lancet windows were set between them. At the forefront of the deck was the wide rose of the splendid pinion's grand oculus. The central pane was a single, flawless piece of transparent steel, but the edge was made up of tiny pieces of coloured glass held in place by adamantium cames. The art was far more beautiful than the view it bordered. A bare ball of rock turned in the oculus, as dead as all the worlds Irwin had seen over the last month. Utterly unremarkable. Irwin lost himself in the circular frieze, as he had many times before. It depicted the first angel's Excelsis in battle. The picture ran into itself so that there was no beginning or end, but an eternity of war. After 50 years in command of the second company and their strike cruiser, Irwin knew every red and white figure in the image by name. Every one of the original 300 founders was remembered in that glass. The battle gear they wore when the chapter was formed had been perfectly reproduced, right down to their name scrolls. Most of them had died within a year. Their first mission had been an arduous one. How Irwin wished for such a glorious struggle now! A chime and a flashing lumen bulb on the command panel drew his attention to the hardline vox. He accepted the communication, praying for reports of something, anything in the system, to kill. His hopes were dashed.
"I have yet to register any signs of life in this system, my Lord Irwin," reported the servile of response.
The pitch of his voice was higher than a space marine, a sign of human weakness. That was why the Emperor had created the Space Marines, to protect frail men who could not protect themselves. Irwin reminded himself of his sacred duty, though truth be told he found it hard not to be irked by his charge's fragility. Irwin looked over to the Vox station, a tiered stage set 50 feet below his throne.
"More information," Irwin commanded.
The servile of response stood smartly and saluted, but he dared not look up at his superior and spoke to the empty air.
"The Astrocatorium records give a population of 5.5 million Adeptus Mechanicus adepts, with an unknown number of servitors, my lord. There are none left. All have been devoured along with a native biome of Sciopitha."
"I can see that," said Irwin testily.
He pointed through the window.
"I have eyes. Maintain broad scanning parameters. I'm not concerned with message content at this stage, only if there are any messages to be heard." "Another dead system," said Sergeant Ackerman. His voice was as miserable as his stolid, blocky face. "Would you consider, my captain, that we strike from this course and head straight for Baal and the muster? Lord Follardark would concur, I'm sure." "The chapter master was clear in his orders," said Irwin. "Scout each inhabited system in this sector before heading to Baal as Dante requested, and so we will check this system thoroughly as we have checked all the rest. Any intelligence we can present to Commander Dante will be welcome, I'm sure."
Irwin settled himself more deeply into the command throne. There was little he could do to make himself comfortable in its marble immensity. The cables plugged into the power ports of his armor prevented that, but he could at least flex his legs a little. They had become stiff with inactivity. Irwin was well regarded as a ship captain, but he longed for the physicality of battle. Facing one's foe upon the open battlefield with sword in hand was a more satisfying experience than the mathematical exercise of void warfare, although even that would be better than this tedium.
"Be vigilant. The enemy may still be present." "We will not be taken unawares, Captain," promised Ackerman.
Irwin smiled.
"You misunderstand. I fear no ambush. I could use a good, honest fight."
Ackerman bowed his head.
"As you command, my Captain."
Erwin gripped the stone lion head adorning the throne's arms and stared out into the void. The red scar draped scarlet shrouds across the cosmos, occluding the bright heart of the galaxy. Sciothopa was a minor nowhere on the way to bigger nowheres, but even these isolated systems had not been spared by the Tyranids. Most of them housed only small human colonies, it being too expensive to provide large populations with protection from the scar's often deadly effects. Outside of the most valuable systems, Imperial presence was restricted to astropathic relay stations, Adeptus Mechanicus research bases, Star Castella, and Wayforts. Every single one had been cracked open and stripped. Erwin looked down at the dull, dead ball of Sciothopa Prime. According to his Ordo Astra charts, it was a living world, with life adapted to the weird radiations of the Red Scar. The Adeptus Mechanicus were present to exploit this resilience, thus far without result. Now they would never have a chance to unpick its secrets. There was no evidence of life left. The seas were dry, the atmosphere sucked away. High-gain picts showed the broken remains of tyrannic feeding tubes on the surface. Standard tyrannid feeding patterns, after sucking up all usable resources, the tubes' most valuable chemicals, were leached away by the departing fleet, weakening them. An act of planet-wide autophagy that left lacy remains to collapse under their own weight. Lights from the splendid Pinion subsidiary craft played over the broken station orbiting Sciothopa. Glaring circles of bright light turned bent girders into shining filigree. Large parts of the station structure were missing, and the rest was close to disintegration. Erwin reckoned it would only be a few weeks before the remains were dragged from the sky by Sciothopa Prime and smashed to atoms on the surface. "They take even the metal," said Erwin. The servile of the watch looked up from his podium over the auger pits, where baseline humans less fortunate than he labored in unbreakable communion with a ship, their eyes and ears removed, and sensory cortexes plugged directly into the Auspectoria's cogitators. "They take minerals of every kind, my lord," said the servile. "I have compared spectrographic analysis of this world with records of how it was. It shows massive depletion of all main range elements. The devourer remakes the worlds it consumes, although I notice a small inconsistency with the oldest records of tyrannic stripped worlds."
"Small enough for me to ignore?" asked Erwin.
The servile of the watch was an earnest fellow, genuinely fascinated with his work. He had been known to bore his masters with unnecessary detail. The servile pulled a neutral expression, making his slave tattoos shift across his face, a sense of motion exaggerated by the low light of the command deck. The servile of the watch was unusually expressive for one of his breed.
"Whether it is relevant or not, I shall leave to your deep percipience, my lord."
Erwin grunted.
"Edify me, then."
"The older worlds show a larger loss of mass. The Tyranids spent longer on each, digesting parts of the planetary crust. They do not remain so long as they once did. Once the biological components of the world have been devoured, they target only sources of refined metals, such as the Mechanicus station here, in preference to the source minerals."
"Then they are running scared, feeding, moving on before they can be interrupted," said Erwin. "Commander Dante has them afraid."
"Or, my lord, they are presented with a surfeit of food. They have nothing to fear. They have too much choice. The Imperium is a banquet to them. They have become fussy eaters."
Erwin shifted in his throne. For the first time, he looked at the servile of the watch properly. He was a wholly unremarkable man to his space marine eyes, a tool of his chapter, here now, soon dead. But there was something about him, an unusual courage. Most humans would never look a battle brother in the eye. Erwin supposed the servile must have a name. He never bothered learning their names, they lived so short a time.
"You dare disagree with me?" said Erwin.
The servile stared out of the oculus, an expression that Erwin took a moment to place.
"Are you amused, servile?"
The servile of the watch dared look at him.
"Yes, my lord."
"Why?"
"I find it amusing that I disagree with you, and you have not killed me."
Erwin slapped his armrest and let out a solitary bark of laughter.
"By the blood, servile, you are a brave one.
To reach a position such as I have, one must be bold, said the servile of the watch.
Erwin had no idea how the serviles were chosen for the roles they fulfilled, and he did not care. Logistics work was no fit use of a warrior's time. That was the duty of the master of the household, an office given in Erwin's chapter to a captain no longer capable of fighting. So it had been since the 36th millennium, when their glorious order had been founded.
You may be right, Erwin conceded. It is heartening to err on the side of optimism. I applaud you, servile, for prodding the uncomfortable truth.
The servile of the watch bowed. Erwin smiled, baring his long, sharp canines.
Now do not do it again, or I will kill you.
Of course, my lord.
Continue scanning the area, said Erwin.
He stood and addressed the whole command deck.
We have a few hours before we must depart. We will make the translation directly to the warp from the nearest gravipause. There is no need to go to the Mandeville Point. This is a dead system. But if there are any Tyranid organisms remaining here, I will destroy them before we leave.
Erwin thought he should not tarry for such pointless exercises, but he and his men needed action. Morale was as important a consideration in war as any other variable.
As you will it, my lord,
responded the servile locum, the mortal who commanded the vessel where the space marines were absent. When Erwin was present, he did his duty by saving Erwin from the dull business of giving orders to the rest of the serviles. Erwin settled himself back into his throne and kicked out one massive booted foot.
All forward, servile of the helm. Bring us around, Sciothopa, full orbit. Make it fast. Let us see if we can find anything to kill. And call in our craft. I've seen everything I need to see of the facility. Give me a maximum gain auger sweep when we break orbit. Absending a target, we leave in 3 hours.
3 hours passed. Erwin's concentration drifted to past battles.
My lord, we have a contact. Something is moving in a debris field 12,000 miles ahead.
Erwin snapped out of his contemplation to full alertness. There was nothing visible against the red void in the oculus.
Hololith, he ordered.
A projection sphere sprang into life over the forward strategium. In its false light rendition, the glow of the red scar was even more lurid. Erwin leaned forward. Away from the dead world, a spread of wreckage was slowly dispersing. Data screed sprang up around the pieces. Subsidiary view fields magnified the larger items to fuzzy, indistinct shapes.
Analysis, he ordered.
A mixture of Imperial and Tyrannic debris. Augur readings give a preliminary estimate of 70% metallic to 30% organic.
The Adeptus Mechanicus put up a weak fight, thought Erwin.
Lock onto the contact. Show it to me.
Adjusting view now, said the servile of the watch.
Servitors mumbled out, rote responses to the servile's commands. The hololithic view swung around. A black shape moved at the heart of a debris field. Then the hololith view encompassed a second and a third shape.
I have 3 targets, said the servile of the watch.
There was an excitement in his voice that Erwin approved of.
Magnify, ordered Erwin.
Living ships moved among the wreckage. Coiled shells sprouted masses of tentacles from wide apertures at the front. Their arms waved, plucking morsels from the shattered carcasses of bio-vessels, stuffing gobbets of flesh and frozen fluids into hidden maws.
A salvage operation, said Erwin.
Ackerman looked up from his screens for a moment.
To what purpose? It does not seem a sensible use of resources. Who knows? I have heard reports that this tendril of Leviathan is preparing to splinter, putting out fresh shoots as it pushes on towards Baal. This could be a seeding swarm, said Erwin. Or it may not. I do not care. They are Xenos, unworthy of life. All that matters is that they are in low numbers and therefore vulnerable. It may be a trap, said Ackerman.
Erwin tapped the arm of his throne.
You're probably right. Prepare for engagement. Do not bring us too close. Attack from maximum range. Bring torpedoes to readiness. We will stand off and destroy them. We should let it be, said Ackerman. This could be what they want. Leave it, said Erwin dismissively. It is alive. It is an enemy. It should be dead. You are too timid, my sergeant. I am cautious, brother captain. Letting the first guide our actions in this war would be a mistake. It is not the first that guides me, said Irwin. You are not captain of the second company yet, Ackerman, and will not be as long as I am alive. We will destroy them. That is my command. He looked at his second in command. From a distance. Cautiously. I heed your counsel, brother.
Firing solutions calculated, my lord. Forward torpedo batteries are aimed and ready for your command, announced the servile belligerent.
How many are required?
3 torpedoes apiece should do it, my lord, said the servile of the watch. I recommend multiple warheads, standard atomics. Recommend full spread of 6 for all targets, barked the servile belligerent.
Is that not a waste of munitions? Said Irwin, testing his men.
Better to be sure, my lord, said the servile of the watch.
Irwin grinned. Very good. 6 apiece it is, then. Time to impact, if we fire from here?
18 minutes, my lord.
Too long, said Irwin. Servile of the helm, bring us closer. Accelerate to quarter speed. Loose torpedoes at 5,000 miles. Prepare 3 spreads, as per the servile belligerent's recommendation, 1 spread per vessel.
I say again, captain, it may be a trap, said Ackerman.
We will release them all and break off, Irwin said to the sergeant. Let the impetus of a ship speed our vengeance away.
Revised time to impact after acceleration is 7 minutes, my lord.
Better, said Irwin.
A short-lived flurry of activity took hold of the serviles. A few moments later, the splendid pinion shuddered as its drive stacks pushed it towards the debris field. Irwin picked out the broken hulk of a small Mechanicus arc ship. He could see none of their warships among the wreckage. Unsurprising for a research system.
I am detecting increased activity from the enemy, my lord, said the servile of the watch.
They have seen us, said Ackerman. If they have, what of it? They will not catch us, said Irwin. Their ships are slow in system. They have no power to give them speed. We will finish these ones easily enough.
We are approaching optimum firing position in 5 seconds, my lord, said the servile belligerent. He counted down. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Irwin raised his hand lazily.
Fire torpedoes.
Volley 1 away, called the servile belligerent. The ship jolted. 6 torpedoes raced from the ship. Second spread loaded, reported the servile belligerent. Target locked.
Fire, said Irwin.
He leaned forward. This brief moment of action fired his sluggish blood. His mouth watered, and his sharp eye teeth slid a fraction further from his gums. He forced his attention away from the men under his command, their warm bodies and pulsing necks, and instead focused on the torpedoes. The hololith dimmed to cut the glare from their drive units. The first spread ran ahead of the ship where it divided into 2 subgroups of 3. The second spread followed the same pattern. The torpedo drives obscured the debris and their targets for a moment, but they were soon far out from the ship, reduced by the unimaginable vastness of the void to jewels of yellow on the wide red sash of the scar.
Third spread loaded and ready, said the servile belligerent.
Swiftly accomplished. Commend the gunnery crews, said Irwin. Extra rations and an additional 5 minutes sleep this rest cycle for such fine loading. Now fire.
The last volley burst from the tubes in the ship's bull-nosed prow, far from the command spire.
Turn about, said Irwin. Full reverse thrust. Turn us away from the enemy. Keep the hololith locked on our targets.
Jets of fire stabbed out from the starboard prow shield, slewing the ship to port side. The splendid pinion groaned under the pressure of the maneuver. Irwin laughed as the ship shook.
Accelerate into the turn, servile of the helm, said Irwin. Servile of Empirical Transit, have a warp engine prepared.
The master of the Enginarium insists activating the core under this stress is unnecessary and risky, said the servile of Empirical Transit.
Noted. Do it anyway, said Irwin.
Ackerman's boots clunked as he activated his suit maglocks. Irwin grinned savagely to see his brother reach out to the dais rail to steady himself. Ackerman was not so strong as he maintained. Inertia pulled the Space Marine sideways against the drag of the deck grav plating. It was good to push his ship and his men so.
Spikes the blood, eh, Ackerman?
Ackerman stared stonily ahead, disappointing Irwin. Ackerman was a fine warrior, but precious little joy was to be had from his company. The ship's real space engines thundered, shaking the command spire with their sudden massive increase in output. At their driving, the splendid pinion swung around in a wide arc, coasting along the gravity plane of Sciopapa and using it to accelerate out of the system.
Perfectly done, thought Irwin. He was proud of his crew, mortal and Adeptus Astartes alike.
My lord, torpedoes about to make contact, the servile belligerent's voice sounded out of the hardline box by the throne, vastly amplified but barely loud enough to be heard over the roar of the ship. The enemy have released torpedo spines and boarding pods in response.
Then destroy them, said Irwin.
The thirst rose in him, eager for the kill.
They will get no time for a second volley.
Indeed they did not. One of the tentacled scavenger vessels disappeared in a sphere of brilliant fire. So bright, Irwin thought. Nuclear fission purged the sick redness from the void for a moment with pure, clean light. Seconds later, the next torpedo spread hit the second ship. Three bright globes of fire were followed an instant after by three more, the six together swelling into a ball the size of a miniature star. Then the third ship was hit, and the small fleet was gone. The fires faded.
All hit, reported the servile of the watch. Targets destroyed. We have debris coming in hard after enemy munitions. Activating point defense systems, said the servile belligerent.
Faintly, right at the edge of Irwin's enhanced hearing, guns chattered. A cloud of approaching shapes picked out in red on the hololith thinned as bio-missiles were shot down. Large segments of the cloud blinked out of existence.
A fine job, serviles, said Irwin.
His brief joy at battle was fading as quickly as the spheres of fire.
Are there any more?
No, my lord,
responded the servile of the watch.
Then set course for the next system.
Irwin glanced over to Ackerman.
Gather the company. I will address them in the siege joyous. We head to Baal after our next reconnaissance at last.
My captain, said Ackerman.
Irwin depressed the head of the leftmost lion. It clicked gently. A flicker of status lights ran over his displays.
Captain departing,
said a machine voice, broadcasting the news across the command deck. Gas sighed as the cables detached themselves from the rear of Irwin's armor. He stood with difficulty, the armor briefly dead on him with neither power pack nor ship to provide energy to its systems. His backpack descended from the ceiling above, the stabilization nozzles delicately grasped by long-nosed grips. Like the ceramite of his arms and legs, it was a marbled white, setting off the deep crimson of his torso plate. His golden helm followed on a telescopic arm. Arming serviles crept out from the dark places at the rear of the dais and wordlessly attached the backpack to Irwin's armor. His growl of satisfaction at the strength flooding back into his battle-plate systems was amplified as his helmet passed over his head and locked into place.
Servile Locum, you have command,
Irwin said, glad to be free of the command throne. He looked out at the throbbing wound of the red scar.
Close the oculus. There is no need to look upon this painful smear any longer. I hear it drives men mad, and it troubles my heart.
The shutters were ground down over the oculus. He strode along the pier and out through the doors at the rear, thence off the command deck. Before he reached the hall of the siege joyous, a servile from the Astropathicum came bearing urgent news. Upon reading the script presented him, Irwin's day became immeasurably better. With a savage shout, Irwin crumpled the parchment, returned to the command deck, and ordered a course alteration to the Zozan system. He would get a proper battle soon, after all. To human eyes, a tyrannid organism was a single thing, a beast like any other. This was not so. Each monster in the limitless swarms was a carefully designed colony of symbiotic creatures. Once incorporated into the High Fleet's genetic knowledge, the baseline genome of those organisms, chosen for a primary host, was paired back to the bare essentials and gifted with the characteristics common to all Tyranid creatures, thick, chitinous armour, a hexapedal anatomy, multiple redundant organs. Characteristics that, above all else, made them incredibly difficult to kill. Only then were the true adaptations added. Though the finished creature may have looked like a complete single being, it was made up of a multiplicity of individual creatures, many of them semi-sentient in their own right. This was most obvious to the casual observer in the weapons borne by the larger constructs, whose repurposed anatomies still retained recognizable biological shapes. There were other, less obvious examples of forced parasitism. Thinking blood. Organs that could live separately from the creature they served. Subsidiary brains that awaited the death of the main nerve stem or the presentation of some unusual circumstance that required specialist knowledge not present in the basic mentality of the creature, both events that might never come to pass. Organs could be installed, fully aware, and live for centuries, never realizing their potential. The Hive Fleet was so huge, it could afford to be profligate with flesh. This modularity of being allowed the enhancement of creatures at short notice, or modification for particular roles. As the Angel's Excelsis annihilated the small Tyranid scavenging fleet, one such colony of beasts approached the splendid pinion. Among the debris of the dead hive ships floated something that appeared to be another piece of biological wreckage, but was in fact a cunningly conceived single-occupant void pod. The nature of the Tyranids made it impossible to say which part of this gestalt biomechanism possessed the guiding mind. Was it the sensor beast, mounted upon the blunt nose, that perceived the space marine ship and originated the nerve pulses that dictated the pod's action? Or was the splendid pinion spied by the eyes of the pod itself? And was it then the pod's rudimentary brain, housed at the rear, that directed it? Or were these elements of the colony subsidiary to the mind of the infiltration beast carried within, that slumbered and yet looked out upon the void through the linked brains of its outer casing? They were all ultimately part of the greater whole of the hive, so which was the driving sentience? The classifications used by the Imperium to define levels of consciousness among the swarm's parts were crude. They lacked subtlety. Perhaps, even at the height of its power, mankind could not have understood the Tyranids. The creature in the pod was autonomous in every way, except when it was not. It was natively cunning, an individual in its own right, but not a thing of will unless it was needed to be. Contradictions to the human mind, but not to the hive. Moist sensor pits, as sophisticated as any imperial auger, scryed the splendid pinion. A calculating mind observed the ship in multiple spectra, and judged it a worthwhile target. In truth, it was all the sub-creatures together, the pod, its subsystem beasts, and the cargo it carried, that made the decision to vent a portion of the pod's meager stocks of propellant. Gas puffed from orifices along the pod's flank, sending it spinning along a random-seeming trajectory resembling the tumble of harness debris. Chromatic cells on the surface flickered to match the color of the red scar void. Counter-auger creatures insisted in the pod's skin digested themselves, their electromagnetic screams sending out a cloud of obfuscating radiation on all frequencies. Silently, stealthily, the pod moved towards the splendid pinion, tracking the metal ship as it pulled away from the debris cloud and made its way to safe translation distance. The pod's journey was a one-time chance, but it was one of millions. It was disposable, as all creatures in the high fleets were. The mere act of fulfilling its purpose guaranteed its death. The component animal of the vessel did not care for themselves. Though several were capable of doing so, having been derived from sentient gene stock, their potential for self-preservation was suppressed, psychically and chemically. They were mind-slaved, devoted to the great devourer in the same way a man's fingernail is devoted to his hand. Gunfire strobed the void as anti-missile batteries locked onto pieces of shell and muscle spinning through the void, atomizing them in bright bursts of radiant particles. The pod corrected its course, moving away from the thicker clusters of wreckage, taking care not to move at all like the smattering of Tyranid torpedo spines streaking directly towards the prey ship. Invisible behind its baffles, the pod sailed, unharmed, through soundless explosions. A separate, distended brain creature housed in a cyst deep in the pod's bony armor calculated the precise speed needed to penetrate the ship's void shields. Too fast, and the pod would trigger the displacement response in the energy field and be sent into the warp where it would be annihilated. Too slow, and the pod would be outpaced by its prey. More precious propellant gases were expended. The pod slowed. Its path became more certain, a parabola that brought it up and under the vessel towards the crags of the ship's keel towers. A soapy ripple on the skin of space marked the pod's position as it punched through the void shield. This was the point of highest danger. The vigilant machine spirits of the vessel might note the anomaly. Now the pod's camouflage was a liability. Not seeing what caused the disturbance in the field, the machines could alert the prey within their dead metal ship. Detection, if it occurred, could not be helped. Countless infiltration organisms had died performing the exact same maneuver, and countless more would. The High Fleet shed them like a human sheds skin cells. Successful infiltration was a matter of probability. It only took one to make it through. The pod hurtled towards the splendid pinion, unseen, as the ship accelerated away from the growing debris field. A desperate venting had the pod match speed with its target. With a final eructation from the rear sphincters, it came within grasping distance. Bony plates blew from around the prow. Flailing tentacles burst from the cavities revealed, their broad, suckered ends slapping onto metal eroded by long exposure to the void. Contact was made. The pod hauled itself onto the hull, its arrival so gentle there was not the slightest impact tremor. Once attached, the pod extruded a gummy foot and hauled itself along the plasteel in search of a crevice to hide within. It found one soon enough, slipping into a space between a turret base and the podium of an angelic statue made faceless by centuries of micrometeor impacts. Once ensconced, it jettisoned tentacles blackened by exposure to hard vacuum and withdrew its pseudopod into the safety of its shell. Sticky resins leaked from pores all along the pod's length, bonding its chitin fast to the ship. By the time the splendid pinion's void shields dropped and were replaced by the eye-aching sheen of Geller fields, the pod was secure. The splendid pinion's warp engines tore open the universal veil separating the void from the Empyrean and plunged into the maddening psychic currents on the other side. As the splendid pinion cleaved the warp towards Zozan, the occupant stirred, perfectly safe in the pod. Hormones and stimulant chemicals gushed into its body, bringing it to a higher level of wakefulness. The Lictor prepared for its mission. Chapter 4. A Greater Darkness. Behind hex-warded gates lay the diurnal vault, the dread library of the Blood Angels, where wonders languished in temporal prisons. Terrible science enslaved a star that powered this fortress within a fortress. Idalia, it was called, shackled by the will of the Emperor and placed into the breast of a statue of Sanguinius that rivaled that at Angel's Fall. The vault was but the first hall of the Librarius. Deeper within were other places, more secret, more dread, the archives of 10,000 years of war. Warded cells, repositories for all the cursed artifacts the chapter had gathered to itself. Depictions of all the foes they had bested. Far, far inside lay the Sepulchrum Maleficus, a place of such secrecy its existence was known only to the very highest officers of the chapter. This was Chief Librarian Mephiston's sanctuary. It was the custom of the older Blood Angels to rest in the Hall of Sarcophagi where they were made, should time allow. Opportunity was limited in those dark days, but the rest was longed for. In the long sleep, infusions of sacred blood carried out all impurity from the body, and spiritual communion with Sanguinius was a tantalizing possibility. Some held that the long sleep staved off the progression of the bloodline's curse. Others, fewer in number, decried the practice, seeing it as an exchange of duty for dreams of the past. Both parties were right, in their own way. Mephiston slept as often as he could. When awake, he secreted himself in the chemic spheres, his self-imposed prison. When he slept among the dead. There were places in the Librarius that defied all known laws, being neither of the universe nor the warp. The strictures of the material plane relaxed. The Sepulchrum Maleficus was one such location. The Hall of Sarcophagi was a place of life. The Sepulchrum Maleficus was a place of death. It was fitting that Mephiston made his abode there. In form, the Sepulchrum was a deep shaft, its bottom, if it had one, lost to the dark. Much of its volume was taken up by moving platforms. Coffins were mounted singly upon the platform's decks, which moved in circular motions like a vast stacked orrery. Articulated stairs linked them, their steps hissing as they whirled around and around, constantly changing shape to accommodate each other in a giant, deadly puzzle of shifting gears. Somehow, the stairs passed through one another when they met, intersecting with the sound of swords sharpening on whetstones. In each ivory casket was preserved the body of a chief librarian of the Blood Angels. Regular infusions of blood kept their bodies fresh. Although they were long dead and their gene seed removed, around many hovered shreds of consciousness, spirits that, being as psychically gifted as Mephiston, might commune with and seek guidance from. At the center of all this was a greater platform, and upon that a singular incongruity. A room with no walls, being bounded like all other platforms in the space by a sheer, unfathomable drop. It was furnished as a study, with a rich rug carpeting the metal. A table and chairs of artistry befitting the chapter occupied the center. A single bookcase, crammed with rare treatises on war and the empiric arts, stood off to one side. Being at the center of the sepulchrum, the room's orbit was smaller than the rest of the platforms, but it moved like they all did, always in dizzying progress, never stopping, a whirling automatic motion that suggested life where there was none. Other staircases led off from Mephiston's study to subsidiary platforms. Upon one of these, Mephiston's personal artificer dwelt. Rendered blind and condemned to live there until old age took him. On another was the Lord of Death's armory. There his grisly armor hung upon an arming stand. Over it, hovering in judgment within a shaft of ruby light, was Vitaris, the chief librarian's ancient force sword. The armory platform rotated away to the grinding of metal on metal. A third presented itself, and it was there that Mephiston rested. Mephiston's sarcophagus was indistinguishable from those of his predecessors. Like the others, the platform was made of iron, chased with feldrite moon silver in designs that grew in complexity towards the central point where the casket was set. The sarcophagus was made of a single, giant piece of ivory carved with cartouches and esoteric blood angel symbology. Nestled between stylized representations of a space marine's pauldrons was a blank-eyed sculpture of Mephiston's visage. In these details, it was no different to its others. Though the precise style of the caskets varied according to the whims of differing eras, in form, they were the same. But where the coffins of the dead were inert, Mephiston's glowed with caged power, it etched lines gleaming with ruby light. About it, a dozen brass rods topped with silver skulls were arrayed like guards around a prisoner. A nimbus played around the casket's rounded head and shoulders, and from this glow occasional bursts of power cracked loudly into the creaking of the sepulchrum, striking the brass rods and leaving them smoking. Inside the sarcophagus, Mephiston dreamed. And that was most unusual. The Lord of Death thrashed against the silk padding lining the interior, ripping free the lines purifying his blood. An unbidden vision had him under its spell, pulling his soul half from his body and thrusting him unmanned into the floors of time.
At Diamor it will begin, said a voice.
A sense of foreboding, a tragedy overtaking his brothers fighting with Astaroth, gripped him. He sensed despair and loss, and bent his mind to see. Grey and green smeared across the dark, a reflection in a pool whose surface was broken. This was no material reflection, but the mirror of the warp. Empiric ripples quieted, leaving Mephiston looking not upon the Diamor system, but on a world he knew well. Cadia, the gateway to the Eye of Terror. His brothers were there, fighting alongside millions of others. The muster was thousands of times the size of that taking place on Baal, but it was immediately apparent it would not be enough. From the wide cosmic road of Acadian Gate came a procession of unending violence. Thousands upon thousands of ships emerged from the Eye of Terror. They bore old hatred out of the past, determined to overthrow the present in a welter of blood. Billions of demons accompanied hundreds of thousands of heretic Astartes. The Black Legion, the Iron Warriors, the Emperor's children, all nine of the Emperor's fallen legions and their lords had come out from their strongholds to rekindle ancient war. All this Mephiston apprehended in a kaleidoscopic flurry of images spread across a single instant. There was no time in the warp. Then the Lord of Death was speeding through vortices of thought, and the vision burst into an infinity of individual pieces. Through fragmentary possible futures, Mephiston witnessed countless acts of heroism, but the end was inevitable. Faces he saw of import included a monstrous Mechanicus priest, an inquisitor out of time, a space marine in the armor of a Black Templar's marshal. There was another faceless presence. A snatch of laughter and the flash of a silver mask accompanied the touch of an Eldari mind. The presence was gone before he could strike it. War and death had come to Cadia on unprecedented scale, and still that was not the sum of the horror approaching the Imperium. Time blinked. Mephiston walked moorland battlefields between the howling sons of Fenris. Demons died under their blades and bolts, but the space wolves were weary, rank with the sweat of days of battle. Their armor was cracked, their weapons blunted. In the distance, a fortress burned in an unnaturally colored inferno. The sky was a livid bruise, neither warp nor void nor cloud, but a seething mess of energies that cast spears of lightning into the ground with explosive force. Demons saw his soul. They snarled at Mephiston as he shadow-walked across the broken moors. He held up his hand and pushed them away with his mind. Once past them, he faded from their minds like the ghost he was. The scene rippled away into another. Cadians fought from behind barricades of their dead, silver machines chased through the sky. The Necrons, thought Mephiston, the first warriors in the endless war, had returned to finish it. Three times over the last months, the Necrons had aided the Imperium. He did not trust their motives at all. Metal minds and soulless intellects prevented his reading their intentions, but their arrogance betrayed the danger they posed. There was something else, something closer in time and nearer to his blood. He searched for it, seizing upon possibility's cloak, but fate shook him free. Time skipped. Tall alien pylons crashed down in flames onto the plains of Cadia. With each toppling structure, the purpled sky twitched expectantly.
Doom!
Roared a voice that no mortal could hear. More pylons fell, collapsing like tall trees burned up in forest fires.
Doom!
The voice was made of many. The death screams of a million human soldiers were drowned out by the triumphal howl of demonkind. Blood scent thickened the air with copper and iron.
Doom!
Screamed the voice one final time. Reality convulsed. Mephiston's soul reeled, struck a metaphysical blow that dented the inviolable energies of his spirit. The sky peeled open. The madness that lurked beyond the veil of the universe was revealed. Mephiston looked into it unblinkingly. He understood what few did. This roiling, limitless ocean was true reality, not the sluggish skin of matter men walked across and fought over, but the endless hells of warp space. He snarled in defiance, preparing to die far from home and out of time. A cool hand touched his spirit lightly, steadying him. A musical female voice spoke from behind a silvered mask.
"Hail, O Lord of Death."
The Eldari. This creature was not part of his vision, but impinging on it. He prepared for battle, for the ancient race were skilled walkers of the psychic veil, witches all. But no attack came.
"We shall not fight, Angel of Death, for I bring tidings. Where, Son of Blood, the time comes when all will change, some for the better, some for the worse."
"Begone from my mind,"
Mephiston said. As he pushed back, he gained a greater sense of the alien. It was one of their dancer caste, the Harlequins.
"You see me?"
She laughed and skipped away through the raging battle, trailing motley diamonds in her wake. The combatants fought on, though the end was coming. The garish sky fell in. Fire and death washed over the landscapes of Cadia, blasting all to pieces. A racing pyroclastic cloud engulfed Mephiston. Had he been there in the flesh, he would have died instantly, no matter his power. It burned his soul, hurling his spirit from one level of being to the next. His vision was enwrapped in shadow, constricted like a corpse in winding sheets. He struggled against its cold press, lying on his back, unable to move. Darkness burst asunder, and he rose up over burning sands to hover in a fiery sky over a hellish land. Mountains of skulls soared to infinite heights. Rivers of blood and fire carved canyons through white deserts of ground bone, while the sky rained thick ash, fragments of souls still hot from the forges of the gods. Horned demons fought one another in every place, their battle older than time itself. For all its seeming solidity, this was no place native to the realm of flesh. To be there was a grave peril to the soul, for he was deep in the warp, in the lands of blood. Had another psyker ventured into Khorne's domain, even in vision form, they would have been consumed by rage and hatred and their souls torn apart. The risk was especially great for the sons of Sanguinius. These things did not happen to Mephiston. His soul was a pillar of ice in a world of fire. He had no fear. Instead, he thought, "How am I here?"
"Because you must be,"
whispered the Eldari into his mind. Mephiston passed unseen over a world of ceaseless war. Demonic creatures and the souls of damned men battled furiously against one another. Armies clashed. Lone warriors dueled. He witnessed a force in the throes of disintegration, comrades turning on each other before the pulses of their vanquished foes had stilled.
"Onward," said the Eldar. "Fear not, you are guarded for a time."
Silky laughter, cruel as the void, caressed his being. Mephiston's spirit approached mountains made of skulls so big he could not conceive of any creature that might have produced them. The mountains were close to one another, and Mephiston flew between them through a narrow defile whose walls were riddled with eye-socket caves and nostril gullies wherein brutish winged creatures fought over scraps of mortal souls.
"Onward,"
said the voice.
"Do not tarry, Son of Blood. You must see before you are seen."
The pass opened out onto a plain that stretched on forever. Upon it, two huge demonic hosts fought, one of black and one of red. The foot soldiers of both hosts were arrayed in vast legions. Individual warriors lost all meaning. The two were opposing seas of different colors, crashing violently against one another. Arcane machines and bizarre armored vehicles, partly of flesh and partly of iron, warred among the limitless multitudes, their guns sounding a constant thunder over the raucous cymbal clash of a billion blades. Most dreadful of all were the generals of the armies, great bloodthirsters of Khorne, flapped over their minions on leathery wings. Rage crystallized, and given will, they fought, wheeling battles in the sky against one another, crying hatred as loud as cannon fire. Mephiston's heart responded. The curse he held subdued rose in him. Being there was pain. Being there was joy. Only the letting of blood would alleviate his suffering and intensify his pleasure. The thirst parched him. The rage tormented him. They fought for his mind, an internal struggle which mirrored that going on below. Red, versus black. He came to the center of the clash, where a vast spearhead of the red-skinned demons had penetrated deeply into the black forces. Giant brass-clad towers ground demon flesh into pulp as they rolled forward, their baroque cannon belching gun smoke. At the very tip of the formation, the most monstrous bloodthirster of them all fought, one of the 8 to the power of 8 to the power of 8 lieutenants of Khorne. So many were the multitudes of the bloodthirsters that no man could know every one of their number. But this creature, clad in brazen armor, ape-faced and fiery-breathed, was known to all those of Sanguinius's line permitted to learn the truth of the warp.
Carbanda,
whispered Mephiston.
Do not speak its name,
urged the Eldar.
You put us at risk.
Then why am I here? Said Mephiston. As if in answer, Carbanda threw back his head and howled with rage so potent the ground shook and the sky answered with peals of thunder. An avalanche of skulls rumbled off the mountain range, burying thousands of combatants alive. Mephiston's fury burned high in his breast. He wanted to descend, to rend and tear with them all.
I must leave here, or I am lost. Release me, Xenos.
Not yet. Watch.
Mephiston's attention was directed to the distance. A titanic act of fire wounded the yellow sky. A slash opened the world from heavens to deeps. Through it shone the cold light of real space stars.
The way opens. The bane of angels comes.
Carbanda roared again, and his rage infected everything within earshot. Mephiston struggled to control himself. He forced himself to observe as the rising tide of fury swallowed his mind. Above the rift, an angel of scarlet fire ignited into being, his wings filling the sky, his outline shivered with heat distortion, his sword burned. The mellifluous voice of the Eldar spoke in Mephiston's ear so close he could feel the thing's breath.
Hold fast. Watch for the end. A lord of men returns. Do not fall, do not fall. Stand fast, two-souled Mephiston. Now is the time of ending and of beginning.
A sheeting flash ended his vision, and Mephiston fell for an age. The Lord of Death returned to life full of rage. He clawed mindlessly at the inside of his sarcophagus. Equipment broke to sparking wreckage, velvet shredded. Soft ivory scored under his nails, the lid juddered on its mountings at his ferocious strength, alarms peeped and whistled, the sepulchrum echoed to the tolling of a bell so large the sarcophagus vibrated as if struck by the clapper. Mephiston was oblivious to the havoc he had unleashed. Out, 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 he screamed in his mind, though only incoherent snarls left his mouth. The machinery that held the coffin lid closed, squealed with oppositional effort. Though the locks were powerful, they could not resist his warp-born strength. He lashed out with his mind, sending a scarlet tide of energy at the sarcophagus lid. With a crack, the ivory lid split in two and bounced onto the platform floor. One half hung from wrecked pneumatic closures. The other skidded through a slick of blood and fell from the platform, banging from the sides of the sepulchrum as it crashed into the indeterminate deeps of the Librarius. Ripping at his own flesh, Mephiston fell forward, tangled in the feed lines and hibernation monitors still plugged into his black carapace's neural ports. Blood squirted from tubes as he tore them free. Mephiston landed in the wreckage of the sarcophagus. Hot anger burned through him. He felt himself, whatever he was, slipping away. Mephiston? Calistarius? Both were at risk. He was in danger of becoming something else again.
This is not your rage, said a cold, impersonal voice.
His voice. Mephiston's voice, though it seemed to come from without.
This is not Sanguinius's sacred rage, it said. Cast it from you. It is impure.
Rapid blinks shuttered over eyes rolled back into his skull. Mephiston convulsed and vomited a thin stream of bloody saliva. With a feral half-groan, half-shout, he pushed the anger out of his mind as if he were shouldering a physical object aside. The rage passed. Gasping from the depths of his soul, Mephiston got up onto his hands and knees. Blood pooled upon the platform around him. Nearby, Mephiston's personal artificer waited stoically for death upon his platform. Mephiston sensed his anticipation. The wretch wished to die.
"You live another day,"
gasped the Lord of Death. Agitated cyber constructs shrieked down from their roosts and warily circled Mephiston. Precious vitae, spiced with chemical improvement, ran from the edge of his platform in a helical waterfall as the Sepulchrum's mechanism continued on its ceaseless course. The bell's tolling summoned the librarians of the Adeptus Astartes soon enough, whether to aid their master or to contain a monster they did not know, but they came down the stairs to Mephiston's platform in strength and armored, the weapons of their minds and fists prepared for the worst. Epistolary Gaius Rasselas arrived first. He was personally closest to Mephiston in the Librarius, but most ready to do what must be done, despite their friendship. The guardians of the spheres came after him, their huge swords at the ready. Rasselas hurried through Mephiston's strange study and onto the steps leading to the rest platform. When his feet were wetted by the pool of blood, Mephiston looked up at his equerry with burning eyes. He was naked, smeared in blood, his long hair sticky with it, savage in every respect. He was nevertheless in control.
"Stand down. I am not yet damned, Rasselas," said Mephiston quietly.
The witchlight shining in Rasselas's face faded, though it never died. His aged features were suffused always by power leaking from warp-damaged eyes. He held up his hand. The warriors behind him relaxed from their readiness for combat and began issuing orders, bringing mindless servitors in to repair the damage to the Sepulchrum Maleficus. Their labors would be slowly performed. Blood thralls under the direction of a tech marine would have completed the work in hours, but only members of the Librarius were allowed into this innermost sanctum. Few outside the Quorum Empiric, the Librarius's ruling body, were aware of its existence.
"Mephiston, by the blood, what has happened to you?" said Rasselas.
He reached for his master. Mephiston pushed his friend's hand away and sat back on his haunches.
"It is the future that should
concern you,"
Mephiston coughed.
"Fetch Afek,"
Rasselas snapped over his shoulder. He looked over Mephiston again, and his frown deepened further.
"And sanguinary priest Albinus, we will have them both look you over, my lord."
The Lord of Death shook his head, sending his blood-thick hair swinging.
"Not now. There is no time."
"Help me,"
Mephiston said.
"Help me into the chemic spheres. I must have answers. Quickly."
Rasselas stood. He nodded, concern writ large upon his grey, bearded face. Mephiston could communicate much with few words.
"Sheathe your swords,"
Rasselas motioned to the guardians of the spheres.
"Carry him."
Mephiston was half dragged down moist, crumbling corridors to the chemic spheres. The room was full of the light of the captive star, Idalia. A milky dome occupied the center. All was pure and white, until Rasselas employed his blood key, injecting the dome with a shot of vitae, sending crimson circuits of psychic power all over its surface and opening the seamless door to the interior. Pale gloom turned pink as he entered, the tracery of activated psychic circuits racing out from his feet. A claw-footed throne materialized from the sanguine glow, and Rasselas motioned that the chief librarian be placed upon it. Mephiston half fell into the throne, swallowing heavily. The guardians retreated, leaving Rasselas alone with his master.
"Tell me what happened,"
Rasselas said.
"I dreamed," said Mephiston wearily.
"You do not dream, not in the long sleep. You do not allow yourself."
"Dream I did," said Mephiston. "I had no choice. An Eldar brought me the vision, I think. There are great forces at play."
He took a deep breath, still weak.
Firstly, something is about to happen to the Diamor task force. I did not see, but I felt it. He struggled through his memories of his vision, but like all dreams, they were fading. I must focus. Help me, Miracellus. The lives of a third of our chapter depend upon it. The epistolary gestured. His eyes flared. A second throne manifested from nothing. He took his place in it and closed his eyes, lending his power to Mephiston's. Their souls entwined, and the two of them looked upon a fractured future. The dark stain of the shadow in the warp encroached upon the Baal system, blotting out the soul light of stars in its wake, and leaving nothing but hungering blackness that spread like ink through water. From the direction of High Fleet Leviathan's approach, there was none of the psychic noise generated by the Imperium's astro-telepathic network. No crackling pops as ships entered and left warp space. No susurrus generated by the multitudinous souls of inhabited worlds. No psychic screams of dying planets. No alien thoughts or psychic echoes from the past. Only a blank and oppressive silence, more forbidding than a storm front. When focused upon, the silence gave way to the chittering of the swarm. Random seeming at first, the horrible uniformity of innumerable minds working in synchronicity became apparent. There was something else, a thrumming tension to reality's fabric that made all shake and vibrate like the skin of a drum lightly struck, though the rhythm it played grew more violent with every heartbeat.
There is a disturbance in the warp greater than that of the great devourer, thought Mephiston. It is what I felt. I saw Cadia in flames.
This is the danger to the Diamor fleet.
Maybe. That was something else, something earlier. We must see.
Let us see if we can join with our brothers, said Rosellus.
Epistolary Asasmael is with them. Let us call to him.
They flew through non-space to look upon the fringes of Diamor. Worlds moved in stately fashion around a blue giant. Unusually placid for a star of its kind, it bathed its planetary children with bright, cyan light. Already the Angelic Blade and the Flame of Baal, the strike cruisers of the Fifth Company, were present, with a small flotilla of escorts, their red livery black in the blue starshine. More blood angels were coming. Mephiston and Rosellus could sense their approach, urged on to great speed through the warp, as if some agency wished them to arrive with High Chaplain Astaroth's force.